Duck Dynasty stars Willie and Corey Robertson are on a mission to spread faith in Hollywood. The Dodgers flip-flop on drag queens dressed as nuns. And conservatives are issuing travel advisories for California and Minnesota over parental rights concerns. We'll have those stories and many more on Higher Ground with Billy Hollowell. I'm Billy Hollowell, and I'm excited to be here for our episode today. This is a new episode of the show, and if you're new to the program here, I guess we can call it a program. It's a podcast. If you're new to the podcast, I bring you light amid the chaos of our world. I dive into the intersection of faith, politics, and culture. And we're going to dive right into the In My Opinion section of the show. If you don't read my column, I would encourage you head over to the Washington Times. I write a weekly column on all sorts of issues. This week, I'm tackling an interview between an abortion doctor and The Atlantic. You know, with the overturning of Roe v. Wade, there has been an increasing flow of what I would call disturbing pro-choice rhetoric. We've had unsettling attacks on pregnancy centers and a whole bunch of other revelations that have sort of come out of this overturning of Roe. You know, a long time ago, it really seems like it was not that long ago, we sort of had this safe, legal, and rare mantra, right? That, though, has morphed into a defend abortion at all costs, and it's a marching order. And we're seeing this guttural reaction right now to the Supreme Court's Dobbs decision. That was the decision that overturned Roe. And what is happening is I think we're watching some progressives, their unrestrained views on abortion are coming to light. You know, when they were saying safe, legal, and rare before, that sounded great. We all agreed with that, right? At the least, that was an area that people could agree on both the pro-life and the pro-choice side. But that seems to have abated. It seems to have gone away, and we now have the defend abortion at all costs group sort of out there. And for quite some time, we have seen, you know, really supporters of abortion access again agree that fewer abortions being performed was better. But then we started to see the Shout Your Abortion movement, and that was well before we saw Roe overturned. And that was strange rhetoric, telling people to shout their abortion, not to be ashamed of it. And that started a few years ago, and it seemed to break a seal of sorts. It paved the way to this more boisterous, even celebratory language that we're seeing in some fringe corners of the abortion debate. But perhaps none of those shifts, honestly, and this is true, could have prepared me for a recent interview that I read in The Atlantic. Elaine Goodfrey, she conducted an interview with Dr. Warren Hearn. Now, Dr. Hearn is an 84-year-old Colorado abortion provider, and he's one of the few physicians willing to perform late-term procedures. Now, these late-term procedures could happen at 30 weeks, even 32 weeks into a pregnancy. And for anybody paying attention, pregnancies, you know, they go about 40 weeks. So that's pretty late. It's toward the end when we talk about late term of a pregnancy. So I want to go through some of the most disturbing, concerning, and shocking elements of that interview. There were things that I read that made my skin crawl, but that also made me pause and gave me, really left me rather, with a number of questions. So let's start with Dr. Hearn's take on late-term abortion. Now, pro-choice activists, they will often claim that the only reason a woman would seek a late-term abortion is due to fetal abnormalities, right, or a threat to the mother's life. Now, data on this is incredibly sparse, and that's an important detail here. You know, you have some studies actually indicating that this is not necessarily true at all. But the narrative is that, again, women who seek late-term abortions, they do it due to the baby or their life having some sort of threat to it. Now, Ms. Godfrey's article is incredibly eye-opening for a number of reasons. Let me read a little portion here. It says, many of the women who visit Hearn's clinic do so because their health is at risk or because their fetus has a serious abnormality that would require a baby to undergo countless surgeries with little chance of survival. She continued, but Hearn does not restrict his work to those cases. Later, she added, quote, Hearn estimates that at least half and sometimes more of the women who come to the clinic don't have devastating medical diagnoses. Dr. Hearn takes teen patients, and this is me now, this is not her quote. Dr. Hearn takes teen patients who didn't know they were pregnant until late into pregnancy, among others. At least one woman, and this part really shocked me, whose husband had killed himself, also reportedly sought a late-term abortion. But it doesn't end there. So just in case you're paying attention, these are not the cases. We're now talking about very heartbreaking situations, but they have nothing to do with whether or not a child can make it to term or a mother's life is at risk. And by the way, if a mother's life is at risk in a late-term pregnancy, why would birthing the baby out not be something you'd be attempting to do? But anyway, when Dr. Hearn was pressed on whether he would perform an abortion on a woman 30 weeks pregnant with no underlying medical crisis, he said, quote, "Every pregnancy is a health issue. There's a certifiable risk of death from being pregnant, period." Huh. That's interesting. Now let's talk about Dr. Hearn's comments on viability. Now, viability, if you're not aware, this is the gestational age at which a child could survive outside of the mother's womb, and it happens to be a major fixture and a point of contention in the abortion debate. And a lot of doctors, most doctors, in fact, presumably would never perform a procedure past that line of viability. Now, viability could be 5.5, 6 months. Generally, it was believed to be 6 months, but we've seen babies survive well before that outside of the womb, right? If they're born premature, they have survived. But Dr. Hearn said that viability is tied to something far more unsettling and shocking, okay? It's not whether or not the baby can live outside of the womb, a woman's willingness to carry a baby. That's according to Ms. Godfrey, who wrote the article. So the willingness of the woman is what is tied to whether or not the baby is actually a baby. Now, the abortion provider's litmus test for readiness to perform the abortion is shocking to me if that's true. That's a remarkable public admission, assuming the presentation in the story is precise and accurate and the quotes and the details properly reflect Dr. Hearn's views. Now, let's talk about the cost of abortion. This is the third piece of the puzzle that shocked me. Now, Ms. Godfrey, who wrote this article, she described overhearing the receptionist at Dr. Hearn's clinic fielding phone calls from women. At one point, the clinic staffer told someone on the phone that the fee would be, quote, about $6,000. Now, the article does note that some organizations sometimes step in to help fund the procedure, and that Dr. Hearn himself has been known to pitch in to cover some of the costs of hotel, transportation, even the cost of the procedure for those who lack the financial resources. Still, $6,000 is shocking. It made me wonder about the monetary elements of these procedures, right? It's the same thing I often wonder about when we talk about the transgender issue. How much are these patients worth to doctors? And how are women finding the $6,000 to pay for this procedure? It is particularly alarming, honestly, in light of the fact that we're seeing that abortions aren't limited, reportedly, to medical crises. Now, there's a spiritual element of this I want to talk about, and this is the fourth piece that really stood out to me, because Dr. Hearn shared some of his personal thoughts, worldviews about the world around us, including the idea that he is spiritual but not religious. He talked about the natural world and the forest being his cathedral. He talked about it being a spiritual experience to see the sunrise or a wild animal. And I just had to juxtapose that apparent love for nature against the backdrop of this career choice, the ending, the systematic ending of the lives of the unborn. And honestly, I was left heartbroken. You know, the miracle of childbearing, of conception, of the growth and birth of a child, it is undoubtedly one of the greatest pieces of evidence of the Lord's workmanship, of his love for mankind. And yet this miracle in this case is being pushed to the side in place of this quote-unquote spiritual nature of these non-human elements of creation. Yeah, the sunrise is beautiful, but it's not alive. It's really a stunning reminder of what the Apostle Paul writes about in Romans 1:25. He writes, "They exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshiped and served created things rather than the Creator, who is forever praised." You know, human beings are set apart from the rest of God's creation. Yet for this abortion doctor, the Bible's advice is really just nonsense. At one point, you know, he notes that scripture says, "Go forth and multiply and dominate the earth." And he says, "and blah, blah." And then says, "That is exactly the wrong advice." And again, it's heartbreaking because the devastating reality is that a person can see beauty in the animals and in the patterns of the sun while simultaneously destroying the life of unborn human beings. I mean, that should send us on our knees in prayer for a changed heart and mind. You know, tragically, Dr. Hearn shared how he once had visions, and this part really also shocked me, that would wake him up in the middle of the night. He would envision a fetus and a beating heart, but he said those images eventually vanished. And as we know, he spent decades on this abortion journey. Now, those remaining nightmares, those are reserved for the unborn babies who undergo the unthinkable, and also for the lives of the mothers and the fathers who have been misled to believe that their children's destruction is the best path forward. Now, you can check out that column and many others over at the Washington Times, but I want to move into our higher ground headlines. This is the portion of the show where we dive into some of the news of the day, and I want to welcome Washington Times reporter Valerie Richardson to the show. She's going to break down some of the stories you won't want to miss. Valerie, you have a number of really interesting stories that you've been working on this past week. One of them, conservatives are issuing travel warnings against California and Minnesota. And we've seen these travel warnings pop up. Usually on the left, they've sort of popped up. Now we're seeing them on the right. Tell us a little bit about what's going on here.
Yes, this was the American Principles Project, which is a conservative group. And I wanted, a couple of days after the NAACP issued its travel warning for Florida, the American Principles Project decided to issue one for California and Minnesota. I'm sure the two events are connected, that this was not a coincidence when it comes to timing. But I think the point they were making was that, you know, there are some policies being enacted in blue states, California and Minnesota included, that are giving people concerns, especially when it comes to issues like parental rights. They specifically issued this warning about laws passed in those states what are called the trans refuge laws. In other words, after a bunch of states started passing measures saying, you know, banning, you know, gender transition hormones and drugs and surgeries for those under 18, you had states like California and Minnesota swing back with their trans refuge laws saying, if you come to our state to get those treatments, then we'll make sure you don't get extradited and we'll protect you from, you know, law enforcement. And what the concern is that some of these laws can be basically used to facilitate runaways. Like a child could run away to a different state to undergo this treatment and the state would protect them or, you know, block them from their parents finding them. Like there's a number of abuses that you could see happening. Now, supporters are saying, oh no, this wouldn't happen. But opponents are like, well, I think this would happen. For example, you could see this happening in a custody dispute. They brought up a scenario where you could take you're in a custody dispute with a child, you know, the non-custodial parent could take the child to California or Minnesota and say, well, we're here for gender transition treatment. And at that point, the California Minnesota courts would basically, you know, be preventing the other courts from having jurisdiction in this dispute. It would be sort of a situation where, you know, like sometimes you see parents run off to Mexico in these cases and the law can't follow them when they have these custody disputes. They're saying that you could see a similar scenario with these states. So that was the basis for their warnings. But I'm sure part of it was basically to make a point that, you know, the NAACP doesn't like some of the rules on critical race theory. Well, you know, conservatives have concerns on the other side of the fence about some of the stuff going on in blue states.
Well, yeah, I mean, even a scenario where you have two different parents with different views on how to handle the issue of transitioning, you know, this just seems very complicated what is happening here. And honestly, regardless of what side of this issue people are on, this is going to be a big 2024 issue in the election. I think parental rights has always been one of those things that people have had concerns about. You know, I think, to be honest, when I look at this, what's happening now, I think these are the things that people might have said, oh, that's a conspiracy theory. That would never happen maybe 5 years ago. And now you've got a couple of states where these things are happening. So I'm interested to see where that goes next. But it's intriguing that both sides are kind of going back and forth on this. I do want to dive into this other related story, because I think it's another very interesting one that's in line of the times with these things that we're seeing happen now. You've got Tennessee defining what is a woman, with Governor Bill Lee signing a bill defining sex in state law. What is happening over there?
Yeah, you see, this is actually, Tennessee is not the first to do this. They're the second. Kansas did this first. But several states are involved in this. I think Montana just passed one. I want to say Alabama's got one that's coming up. Basically, they're part of this whole wave to, you know, nail down definitions of sex because they want these definitions in state law. The purpose is so that, let's say, unelected bureaucrats or state judges can't define sex as including people who are basing their sex on gender identity. In other words, these laws all contain biological components. They're based on your reproductive organs. They're based on your chromosomes. They're defining sex based on biology so that you don't have a situation where your Department of Education decides for purposes of sports that males who identify as females get to participate in female competitive scholastic sports. Trying to, in other words, take it out of the hands of courts and agencies. And the whole thing kind of started with the Independent Women's Forum, which is a conservative group. They teamed up with the Women's Liberation Front, which is a self-described radical feminist group that is very concerned about the whole transgender agenda. And the two of them came up with these a Women's Bill of Rights that defines women based on biology. And they were, you know, sort of pitching that to the states. And Kansas passed it and then overrode Governor Laura Kelly's veto. She's a Democrat. Then Tennessee passed it. Montana just passed it. I think Alabama's about to pass it. And these come in addition to a lot of other transgender-related laws that are passing in red states regarding, you know, those preventing those from under 18 from getting gender identity surgeries and drugs, for example. It's and also banning, boys and young men who identify as girls and women from participating in female elite sports. So it's just one more thing you've got on the plate here in the state legislatures that's all connected to basically the transgender issue.
Right, and it's all anybody is talking about for a lot of reasons because there's a lot happening. It's really, the last story we talked about, this story, you hear people talk about a national divorce and how the blue states and the red states are so different and all these different things that are going on. When I look at this though, and I see the two different sides and how it's being talked about, I mean, when you look at the Human Rights Campaign, there's a quote in your story where the legal director there says, "Let's be clear, the goal of this bill is to exclude the LGBTQ+ community from non-discrimination protections." That is, you know, clearly that is one position, but the other side would say, but we're concerned about all the things that you just referenced. We're concerned about biological men competing against women. There seems to be no real sense of this being a complex issue with very different positions on it. And it makes you wonder, how do you move forward? And I'm not asking you for the answer to this because I don't think any of us have it, but how do you move forward in a country where the ideas are just so radically different on these major issues? It's a little mind-boggling, honestly.
Yeah, I think really what you're seeing right now is what some people have described as radical federalism, where you're going to have, you know, in some senses, two Americas, you know, not a secession situation or a civil war situation, but states that have some very, very different laws from other states. And there's going to be a very stark divide. You already see it with abortion. That's probably where you see the starkest divide, but you also see it with the transgender issues, parental rights issues. All of these things are really creating, you know, what you could describe as two Americas, because increasingly states are either on one side or the other. This year, we have, I want to say, 39 trifectas. What that means is the governor and both houses of this legislature are controlled by the same party. That's more than we've seen in at least 20 years. And when you have that, you get very different policies. Now, it'll be interesting to see over the next few years if that changes. Do they become more separated? Or do people start saying, you know, we need some compromise on this? And you see more states, more purple states, more policy compromises. It'll be interesting to see.
It will be. And I think, you know, we're also watching people, and this sort of came up in what you were just talking about a little bit ago, but we're seeing people who don't agree on anything coming together on some of these issues. And I think that's really interesting. Even watching a Richard Dawkins, who's a, you know, as atheist as you can get, saying things on the gender issue that sound like they might partially be coming from a conservative evangelical Christian is really interesting to watch. And There's another story you covered where you have different sides coming together. You have Muslim and Christian parents out in Maryland, Montgomery County Board of Education, rather, really protesting what is going on there, this no notice, no opt out standard that's gone into effect for the next academic year when it comes to these LGBTQ inclusive texts. Again, here we are talking about this issue again. Tell us a little bit about what's happening in that story.
Yeah, what's interesting there is, you know, you obviously see a lot of school districts across the country that are pushing LGBTQ texts. A lot of parents have problems with some of these books because some of them are pretty graphic, you know, especially when they're taught in the younger grades. But what's interesting in Montgomery County is the Muslim parents are kind of taking the lead in this. And normally, you know, you see the people on the other side say, well, these are just, you know, these, you know, radical Catholics or whatever the FBI was calling them, Catholic nationals, or, you know, these, you know, radical evangelical Christians or what have you. But in this case, CARE, which is a Muslim group, and the local Muslim community association went to Montgomery County and said, you've got to give us the opt-out. We have to be able to opt your kids out of some of these lessons because we these don't align with our religious beliefs or our values. And Montgomery County said, no, we're not going to do it. They used to have the opt-out, but once they introduced these books, I get the feeling, you know, this is my surmising behind the scenes, a lot of parents were opting out. And so all of a sudden in March, they said, no more opt-outs. And plus, we're not going to notify you when the books are being discussed in class. And parents obviously have a problem with this. And so you saw two Muslim parents and four Catholic parents sue earlier this week, Montgomery County, basically just to get the opt-out back. They're not even trying to get the books kicked out of the school system. They're just trying to get an opt-out provision. And it's in federal court, and we will see what happens.
Yeah, these are interesting cases to watch when you have teachers standing up as well. And, you know, you've got at least one case out in California where there are two teachers who are suing over claiming they've been forced to lie to parents about the kids in their classrooms' gender identities. I mean, there's a lot happening across the board with parents and also now teachers. So it will be interesting to watch. Now, this last story we're going to talk about here briefly. I mean, this is an interesting one because we talked about the first part of the story with the Dodgers, the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence. You know, they were sort of booted out over the controversy from taking part in this Pride event, but the Dodgers have essentially now apologized and have brought them back in. Can you break this one down for us?
Yeah. The Dodgers are deep in Bud Light territory with this one because they've had to flip flop and they've had to flip flop twice now and it you know it doesn't look particularly good for them. But what they did was they had invited the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence to, which is a drag queen group, to come and get a community service award. And a bunch of Catholic groups found out about this. They objected to it, saying these people are basically just mocking Catholics right and left. They make fun of our religion. They have these really, you know, sexual and, you know, borderline obscene names for a lot of the sisters. They take part in these performances involving the cross and figures supposed to be Jesus that are very sexual. I mean, you know, they're like, if you invite them, you're basically, this is a slap in the face to Catholics. And the Dodgers are like, whoa, okay. So they uninvited them. Well, then there was a huge LGBTQ pushback in Los Angeles. And then in response to that pressure, the Dodgers re-invited them. So now the sisters are coming back and I'm sort of waiting to see what the next move is by some of these Catholic groups. But yeah, it's a situation where, you know, when these issues are becoming very, I mean, the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence have been around for 40 years. I'm not sure how many teams have tried to give them awards, but what I would say right now is the climate is just fraught and people are really watching for this stuff. People are upset about it. And when they see big corporations sort of aligning themselves with the transgender movement, a lot of people are getting upset about it because they have real concerns about things like the sports and the kids getting treatments under the age of 18 and the schools not telling you when your child has changed their name and pronouns. All of these issues are a big concern, not just to conservatives, but, you know, to people and parents across the board. And so when corporations get involved, they really get stuck in a no-win situation because they're damned if they do and damned if they don't. You know, that's what Target's finding right now because they, you know, they had to respond to their big Pride collection, part of which was designed by a Satanist-inspired British designer. and they came out and apologized and they removed a few items and they definitely removed some items off their website, but most of the stuff's still there in the stores. And so it was kind of a lukewarm Bud Light response where, you know, they didn't really do a whole lot, but they And I think one reason is that they know if they, because they've already getting, they're already getting criticism from the LGBTQ movement for what little they have done. And so they're really sort of in limbo right now, you know, because there's, you know, there have been calls to boycott Target for years. They've never really taken off. This one seems to be doing better, though, because they lost $9 billion in market capitalization from a week ago based on yesterday's stock price. So
yeah,
it's this one seems to be taking Bud Lighting.
Well, and yeah. It's like, you know, one of the things I feel like a lot of this should be in a textbook of what not to do as a business, right? Because you're watching it unfold, and it's like even partnering with somebody, if I was going to partner with somebody, I would do a very solid vetting of other products they made. Even, you know, and I think a lot of people were putting misinformation out too, saying they were selling Satanist products. They weren't, but the designer, yeah. As you said, the designer has talked about Satanism, designed Satanist themed different projects and products. And yeah. So this is something you would think, oh, maybe I'm going to think twice, because that's going to come back and really bite me if I do that. And yet, again and again, we see these very strange decisions being made. And, you know, you're right, they're in a tough spot on this. But even looking at the reaction, I mean, there's one tweet that you included in the story from the Los Angeles LGBT Center, and it says, last week's debacle underscores the dangerous impact of political tactics by those who seek to stoke the flames of anti-LGBTQ bias at a time when our rights are under attack. But the photo attached to that tweet is two of these people, I assume, in the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, like kissing a cross, right? And so you're thinking, well, this is the imagery that is upsetting people. And of course, we live in a free society. You can post these things and do these things, but this is something that is going to rile people of faith. And so I'm interested to see where it goes next. And Valerie, I appreciate you breaking down all four of these really interesting stories for us today.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me on, Billy.
And that brings us to today's featured chat. You know, as you know, we bring you some amazing guests every week. I recently had the chance to sit down with Corey and Willie Robertson of Duck Dynasty. They've got an amazing new production underway. It's a play, and it's showing down in Texas, telling the gospel story through music and just incredible storytelling. So with no further ado, let's welcome Corey and Willie Robertson to the show. Willie and Corey, welcome to Washington Times Higher Ground. Excited to have you here today.
It is awesome to be here. How are you?
I am doing well. And you guys are doing well because you've got a new show coming out, a new play. It's called His Story, the Musical. And we're going to get into that and talk about that. But I want to start somewhere else because I have been incredibly intrigued by a number of things about your family over the years, interacting with you guys, getting a chance to sit down and talk with you. But even from afar, watching how faith has remained central to who you guys are. You have not deviated from that. You have not experienced the things that other people do when fame hits them. What is the secret to that? How have you kept so close to your faith?
Prayer. For real. Whenever we did, I'll never forget whenever we first got asked to do Duck Dynasty. I think we had been doing some little things in television and all that before then, but whenever we got asked to do this on A&E, it was this moment for our family. We were like, okay, you know, this could be great for us and for our family and a great witness to God, and we could point people to Him, or it could destroy us. And so we came together and we said, like, we're going to come around the table and we're going to pray. We're going to ask God's hand on it. And we said, if it's not helpful, if we're not pointing people to you, if it's tearing our family apart, take it away. And so we really did just kind of give it to God from the very beginning. And faith is, it's everything to us. And so people would ask us, I remember when the show first started, they're like, are they going to show that y'all are Christians? And we were like, well, they can't really get around it because it's who we are. You know, it's just part of our life. And so, yeah, I guess I would say,
yeah, I mean, getting our faith out has always been, you know, that driving mission. I can remember going to Dad and saying, Dad, they want to do a big show, a reality show about us. And Dad thought it was a terrible idea and nobody's going to watch it. And I said, well, Phil, perhaps we could get the gospel out even more. It'll be a bigger platform. And he looks at me and he goes, you think we can really get the gospel out to more people? I said, I believe so. And so Phil gives me that's him saying, signing a contract. He gave me the thumbs up to pursue the venture. And so, but you know, at its base, that's what it's all about, which is getting his story out to more people. And so mom and dad had been passionate about that. Corey's family was passionate about that. Our grandparents were passionate about that. And so we have these opportunities to do that. And in all sort of weird and interesting ways to do that through a television show and now through, you know, which has led to books and podcasts and movies and all these different platforms that we can try to get the gospel out. And so, and what we find now is we can band together with other believers throughout the world, and especially America, who have the same passion. You know, there's people in Hollywood, and there's people in business, and there's people in all kind of different areas who are just as passionate as we are, and just trying to find, you know, the ways to do that, to work around the evil one who puts barriers up and, you know, and certainly, is ruling the world, it seems like even more and more, but that light keeps coming through, you know, we just keep lighting fires and keep that light coming, and it's exciting, and it leads you to be mission driven, which is what we love. It's not about success or money or fame or any of this stuff. We all know that's here today and gone tomorrow, but that real mission, you know, finding that deep mission, I think a lot of people are really searching for that. And I think projects like His Story hopefully can open that up, especially amongst young people. I mean, who else is suffering more now than young people? I mean, let's face it, they're just barraged, and with COVID and with the internet, with, you know, all the things and fentanyl and all these things. And so, you know, we can either sit around and cry and complain about the world and how the enemy wins, or we can try to do things positive to bring them out of that darkness. And I think projects like this hopefully will help, because it certainly seems like the Lord's got his hands all over it, because I don't know how it happened this fast and how we're even involved, but we're thankful that we are.
Well, and let's talk about that, Corey, because His Story, the musical, down in Dallas, opening up a really, really cool project. What are you hoping to see accomplished through this as far as impact goes?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I have to tell about the writer, because Anna Brown was 16 years old when she heard the musical Hamilton. She heard it just someone, she heard the music from it. And she felt like the Lord told her to do this for me, like write a musical about me for me at 16 years old. And
she wasn't a music writer.
No.
Oh, wait. So she didn't have experience. I mean, obviously she was 16, but this wasn't like a passion area for her at the time.
No, the other day she was telling the story and she said, so my sister taught me four chords and I started writing it.
Yes.
I mean, it was that crazy.
Like talk about a calling on somebody's life. Wow.
Yes. So over the next year, she wrote 40 songs that became this musical. And when we found out about it, we heard it and we're just blown away. And then the whole thing was already written. So we got to just hear the whole thing and we were like, whoa, it's full of scripture and truth. And it is just tells the story of Jesus in this like really unique, fresh, young, powerful way. And so I think that's one of the things that we're most excited about. It is young. It comes from a young person she's 22 now, but it comes from this younger generation that we've seen God work powerfully in. We just saw, you know, the revival in Asbury. We see what God's doing through our own kids who were in their 20s. And just to be able to champion that and say like, oh, this is something new and fresh and different. And it's going to reach people that might not walk into a church building or might not open a Bible. And it's going to reach them and move them in different ways.
Yeah. And this wasn't brought to us by, you know, our pastor friends or any big church. It was actually brought to us by people in Broadway, you know, who I think associated, I think those people like Jesus. So maybe it was your thing, you know, it was literally that kind of thing. So, so that was one of the cool ways I think that God works that Corey and I have been keen to and going, there's something, and that's something we can champion, especially for fellow believers, especially for someone like, you know, Anna, who's young, who's saying, I have this project, and even the people that were saying, this is really great. Yeah. You know, you guys are believers. Can we get behind this and inspire people and hopefully start conversations? One of our hope is that people can go that maybe are confused about Jesus, maybe have no idea. And they find themselves that they wouldn't be at a church building. They're at a tent in Dallas, Texas, and are going, I've got questions about this. And so, and then hopefully we can answer those questions.
Yeah. Well, it's so interesting you say that, because I was just looking at some stats and numbers, and the Southern Baptists, right? Just one, it's the biggest denomination, Protestant denomination. But they had a decline in churches, a decline in all these numbers, but there was an increase, a 16% increase in baptisms. And I thought that is so interesting to me, right? In light of what is going on right now, in light of coming out of COVID and all of that chaos, the fact that I think it was over 100,000 more baptisms or that had happened this year. And I thought that's a really powerful message that people need different ways to be reached with the truth.
Yes.
And because they're not hearing it, right? So you guys are doing that through the musical, you're doing it through shows. I mean, talk a little bit about some of the projects that you guys are pursuing and working on.
Well, one thing on that, I want to say that I think churches too, I think they were trying to just get people in, I think, for years. And then there's like, as long as you're here. And then what happened with COVID, they left. So the ones that were kind of wishy-washy just took off and said, okay, we're out of here. This is a big group and we're not meeting. So you kind of saw, and I do see that. We've seen it even in our own church, and to where you're finding people who are, they're searching, and maybe perhaps with the baptisms, maybe they said there's real life change. But a lot of the ones who were just kind of halfway ended up going back. And our hope is that they'll be back. Yeah. They'll find that, hey,
yeah,
what the world's offering, because not that going to church is the end all be all for sure. You're looking for that real life change where people are like, I'm going to live my life for Jesus. And so perhaps that's what that is. But that's encouraging.
Yeah. There. And what I think, as you were saying that, I was thinking about what I love about this is, like, we're not introducing people to a church or to a religion or to, we're just, this is just straight to Jesus. It's his story, you know, and that's it. And so, yes, the church is important. The church is the bride of Christ. And then that is where you find community and all of that. But the first introduction needs to just be to Jesus. And that's,
if you don't understand
about
Jesus, you're never going to understand the church.
Yeah.
So it starts
right. Yeah, it seems pretty central. Yeah. You know, it's interesting because Dr. George Barna, you know, he's a researcher, and we had him on, and he was talking about the fact that just 4% of Americans have a biblical worldview right now, and it was 6% in 2020. Somehow we lost 2 percentage points. And I look at that, and he was talking a lot about the role of parents, right? And how important it is for parents, and millennials, unfortunately, are not as biblically literate. And so it's going to be really hard to raise the next generation with a biblical worldview. But he was talking about the importance of parenting. And I look at you guys, I mean, you have your grandparents now, you have raised incredible children who are close to the Lord. And I think a lot of people look at that and they look at your family and they're like, what's the secret? You know, how did you guys do that? And so I'd love to hear from both of you on that, because I think it's a real pressing issue in light of everything we're talking about here.
Yeah. Well, I think we were both blessed with a generational faith. You know, it was passed down from our parents. We did have homes where the scripture was talked about, was read, was, we were taken to church, those type of things. So we pass that down to our children, but it was only one generation before in Willie's family when his parents turned their life mm-hmm. around. And so it can happen at any moment. You can start that for your family. And like you mentioned, there's, you know, the percentage is very small, but you can start that for your family. And I think it's really just making Jesus and faith central to who you are, not just like one of the things that happens, you know, on Sunday morning and then everything else in the week, but making it central and just a part of who you are in your day-to-day life and affect how you live and the way you treat others and the way you, you know, you kind of walk on this earth.
Yeah. It's, I think it's that true authenticity, that it's way more than just showing up to a building for an hour and then living your life, differently, you know, than what you saw people talking about there. I think hopefully our kids have seen that. It's not that you're above mistakes. I think that's mm-hmm. some of the mistakes we made in the past, which was somehow it had to look like perfection. And so you did everything to make your life look perfect so that your kids, a lot of kids rejected that because they're like, these guys aren't perfect.
Yeah.
Even though they're portraying that, they're not really like that. But it's what you do when there's mistakes. It's how mm-hmm. you treat each other then. It's how you treat each other throughout the week. And so, and we've always had a passion for sharing that faith. And that's what I learned a lot from my father, which was, he was just ravenous about going after the lost. And so I saw him just day after day, week after week, on Fridays, on Saturdays, on Mondays, you know. And so I picked up on that, and so learned to share my faith as well. And so there's been that as well, which helps keep me on mission. It's like, we're going after lost people. And so, and I truly believe in the book that's coming out, you'll hear that about, that was Jesus's mission. You know, when he left, he said, make sure that's what you go do. When he saw Peter and the guys on the Sea of Galilee, he said, let's go fish for men. I mean, that was such a central message. And I think sometimes we forget that. We get faith and we get Jesus and we're like, great, it's over. But it's not. It's now it's, well, who else can we go get? And so I think staying on that mission has been very important for us. And I believe our kids saw that.
Well, I absolutely love that. And again, the musical is His Story, the musical. People can check that out. Corey, where can they go for more information?
HisStoryTheMusical.com, and you can get tickets there. And yeah, I hope to see you in Dallas. This is going to be one of those destinations. It's an incredible venue. There's not a bad seat in the house. It's really just going to be
it's in a tent that's really air-conditioned. The ceiling is also like a projection screen. So it's almost like a planetarium, like a Cirque du Soleil. With a stage that's round that moves. And I mean, it's, you know, once people see it, they go, oh, this is really incredible. So they would not be let down when you come see it, but you got to show up. You got to be there to check it out.
Well, I love it. And I love that you guys are doing everything you just talked about, Willie, spreading the truth, doing it through all these interesting means. Looking forward to having you back again sometime soon.
Awesome.
Great talking to you.
That brings us to the end of today's Higher Ground with Billy Hollowell. Head over to Higher Ground on the Washington Times and be sure to subscribe to the show and go over to Apple or wherever you listen to Higher Ground with Billy Hollowell and give us a rating. I appreciate that 5-star review. Looking forward to seeing you all again next week.